This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to the Law Report. Damien Carrick with you. Later, we'll look at a Queensland workers' compensation case, which involves a McDonald's worker who broke her leg after a rooftop cigarette break. This smoko compo combo is a very interesting decision and clarifies the law in Queensland. But first, to last Monday's release of the final report of the Royal Commission into misconduct into the banking, superannuation and financial services industries. Commissioner Kenneth Haynes' Royal Commission sat for 68 hearing days. It received 10,000 submissions and heard from more than 130 witnesses. And his final report contains 76 recommendations. Jared Brody is the CEO of the Consumer Action Law Centre, an organisation which did a great deal to agitate for this Royal Commission. Indeed, six of the 27 consumers who appeared before the Commission to share their harrowing stories are clients of the Consumer Action Law Centre. Jared Brody, welcome to the Law Report.
Thank you, Damien.
In a nutshell, will these 76 recommendations protect consumers into the future?
Look, I definitely hope so. If they are implemented fully, I think consumers should expect to say goodbye to the hard sell every time they contact their bank. I'd like to think that if these recommendations were adopted, particularly the ones that deal with the way in which bankers are paid and commissions and incentives, then we won't have to deal with that anymore and bankers will revert to providing a service for their customers rather than just selling us junk we don't need.
The Royal Commission found that ASIC, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, and APRA, the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority, certainly didn't do a robust job in keeping the banks in check. What did Commissioner Kenneth Haynes have to say about the way these regulators operate?
One of the key findings he made was that they were too, I guess, gun-shy in going to court. Rather than taking legal action where they observed breaches of the law or alleged breaches of the law, instead they would negotiate with the bankers to resolve the situation out of court or issue an infringement notice, which is a lower form of penalty. And Commissioner Haynes has really took them to task over this and said that the regulators should be asking the question, why aren't we going to court when they observe a breach of the law? And so that really...
And seeking maximum penalties.
Yeah, absolutely. He was really concerned that these lower level responses don't create the required deterrence.
So he made these conclusions about the way the regulators have been operating up until now. But what did he recommend? He didn't recommend any draconian overhaul.
No, he certainly didn't. He has sort of made some recommendations around the way in which these regulators should go about their job. So go to court more was sort of one of his things. He's also recommended a new oversight body, a three-person panel, I believe, whose job will be to assess whether the regulators are meeting their statutory objectives.
So, do you think this is a sufficient way of bumping up the regulatory architecture in this industry?
Well, I think if the concern is about accountability of the regulators, then we must think about accountability to whom. At the end of the day, the regulators are there for the public, for all Australians. So I would have liked the accountability mechanisms to be much more about accountability to the public. For example, why aren't all complaints that consumers made to ASIC made public? Then we can assess, are they actually picking up the issues and resolving them when there is consumer detriment?
I understand there has been in recent times some change of the guard at ASIC, but there's been no change of personnel in the senior ranks of APRA, I understand. Is there perhaps a need to kind of clean out these organisations as well?
Look, I think, well, you're right. So at ASIC, there has been a large turnover at the commission level. There's a new commissioner, there's two new deputy chairs. I think APRA undertaking its own enforcement review at the moment, we might see that results in some change to some leadership there. I think at the end of the day, though, these regulators aren't resourced sufficiently to do the job that government tasks them to do. You know, the big end of town, the big banks, the big insurance companies, they have buckets of money to pay well-qualified lawyers to work out the way to get around the rules and to take the regulators to court.
Does Commissioner Haynes make any recommendations about the resourcing of these regulators?
He doesn't specifically know, unfortunately, although I know the government has sort of foreshadowed that there will be announcements about resourcing for regulators in the federal budget this year.
In his report, Commissioner Haynes makes, I think, 24 referrals for criminal or civil actions. He's making those referrals back to ASIC and to APRA?
That's correct.
How soon are they likely to proceed, and what are the challenges and timelines around those actions?
Well, some of them, I must say, have already started. So after his interim report, we saw ASIC initiate a range of legal actions against some of the banks.
What for?
So for example, fees for no service against the National Australia Bank. That was obviously a key concern that came up in the financial planning round of hearings. I think that we're likely to see much more of that coming out over the next 12 to 18 months.
Jared Brody, let's now talk about the fundamental root cause or causes that led to the rot that we've seen in these industries. What do you see as the fundamental problems which allowed the rot to extend as widely and as deeply as it has?
One of the big ones is incentives. Incentives really matter to how people behave, whether they're executives at the front line, whether they're the teller that is serving you over when you're depositing your money. And the way in which the banks set their remuneration structures, the way in which they set sales targets, the incentive on all levels inside the bank was to sell your products to make a profit. They had less of a concern about whether that product was suitable for you, whether it was going to offer you value, whether it was actually going to help you achieve your financial goals. What the commissioner has said around that and around the conflicts of interest that are at heart as well. On conflicts, the commissioner was very clear in his disparagement of the range of conflicts of interest that exist in the finance sector. So, for example, intermediaries, the mortgage brokers or people selling your car loans in the car yard, they're selling it for their own purposes of making money, not to deliver what the duty they owe you in providing you a good service.
What is Commissioner Hayne recommending to tackle these structural cultural problems, these fundamental conflicts of interest? And are they going to be sufficient?
He has made a number of recommendations around the way in which intermediaries in the financial market are remunerated. So mortgage brokers, for example. He actually recommends that we should move away from commission selling and the consumer should pay for the mortgage broker advice through an upfront fee.
So they kind of know what the lay of the land is, right? There's no conflict of interest in the mortgage broker isn't selling something which might well be profitable for him or for her. In terms of his relationship or her relationship with the bank.
Yes, and I guess it matters who pays. So if the consumer's paying, they know who their customer is. When the big bank was paying them through trailing commissions or hidden upfront commissions, it was the big banks that were the mortgage broker's customers and not the actual customer themselves.
I've read that there are a range of recommendations which seem incredibly common sense. Car dealers will no longer be exempt from the National Consumer Credit Protection Laws. Why were they exempt?
This is a really good question. I mean, the National Consumer Credit Protection Act came into effect in 2009. And at that stage, consumer advocates and even the regulators, I must say, argued strongly against these loopholes and exemptions in the law, including those that apply to car dealers and other point of sale retailers. And there isn't really a good reason other than some concern about regulatory burden. You would expect when buying a financial product, you deal with professionals who are regulated as such. So it makes sense for these loopholes to be closed.
Do you think these recommendations, these 76 recommendations, sufficiently address all the loopholes, all the conflicts of interest?
He made one overarching recommendation that loopholes and exemptions should be removed as a matter of course. So we may see a law reform around a simplification of the law to remove these across multiple areas that he didn't even name. At the end of the day, there is some structural issues in our banking sector as well, right? So the big banks, they also are the ones that have financial planners on staff. They're manufacturing the product and then they advise you on your product. Commissioner Hayne acknowledges that itself is a conflict of interest, but he hasn't really addressed this concern about whether our big banks should be broken up.
That's an issue around vertical integration, that they're actually involved at every phase and they're almost selling to each other. But he shied away. He didn't make any recommendation about whether or not that vertical integration should be addressed.
No, but what he did note was the government has already tasked the ACCC, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, to undertake 5 yearly reviews of vertical integration in our financial services market. So I don't think it's off the table, and it will take to task if it sees a consumer detriment from these arrangements.
How will the recommendations of the Royal Commission, assuming that they are implemented, improve the options or the pathways for consumers who feel they've had a rough deal from the banks and other financial people?
Well, hopefully the way in which banks resolve complaints will also be improved. We actually have a new body, the Australian Financial Complaints Authority, known as AFCA, which is an independent body that can assess a complaint between a consumer, a bank or insurance company. And its powers are quite strong. It can, you know, consider not only the law and what's reasonable in the circumstances, but also fairness. So it can make a determination that it thinks that a particular practice by the bank is unfair and rule in the consumer's favour. It will also have stronger powers to resolve systemic issues, so that's issues affecting more than that individual complainant, and there'll be greater requirements on it to refer matters to the regulator. So I think that will put an added onus on our regulators to get on and resolve these things at an enforcement level as well.
That's a dispute resolution or complaints handling scheme for disputes which emerge in the future. For disputes going back 10 years into the past, there's also going to be a redress scheme funded by the federal government.
Yeah, that's right. There are many people who have been successful with complaints and actually had an award of compensation made in their favour, but the particular financial advisor, say, has gone out of business and hasn't paid it. So the government is stomping up $30 million to make sure those people are not left out of pocket. They're also proposing, importantly, a new last chance compensation scheme going into the future. So this sort of issue can't happen again. And this will be industry funded. They'll have to upfront contribute an amount that will be available to pay consumers if a compensation award is made in their favour and remains unpaid.
Jared Brady, finally, six, I think, of your clients from the Consumer Action Law Centre appeared before the Commission. Can you tell me about some of your clients who appeared as witnesses?
Yeah. So firstly, there was a man, Mr. Robert Regan. Mr. Regan is an older man who was actually the subject of a scam, a romance scam. And he, over time, frittered his life savings. Then, without any money left, a broker enticed him to take out a home loan against his home, which he owned outright, of $50,000. And then that money went across to the scammer as well. Now, the bank in question failed to do the appropriate checks about whether this loan was affordable for him. Another client, Irene. Irene was a single mother struggling with a number of debts to credit card companies and even payday lenders. She was doing it tough. And her case study focused on a type of consumer credit insurance sold to her by Commonwealth Bank. So this is a type of add-on insurance that they bundle with your credit card and then purportedly will pay out if you're unable to make your credit card minimum repayments. Her policy was only ever going to pay out if she was working, and she was sadly unemployed, which, again, the bank knew about. At one stage, she actually contacted the call centre because she was struggling with her repayments and saw this was coming out, the premiums every month, and she asked them to have it removed. And they said, oh, no, this is in your interests. We're not going to remove it. And the Indigenous woman who was sold funeral insurance that really offered her very limited, if any, benefit, and Grant Stewart, who spoke about his son getting cold called over insurance again by an insurance company.
Have you spoken to any of your clients since the release of the final report? Or what do they think of this?
I think the clients that we've worked with throughout the Royal Commission are really quite proud to have made a contribution to making a fairer financial services marketplace, although it burdened them individually to have to tell their stories. Actually, some of them said to me that, you know, they were really reticent about it. They were really scared to do so. But once they'd done it, once they'd told their story, they realised what a powerful impact it can have. And so we're really pleased to do that.
Jared Brady, thank you very much for speaking to The Law Report.
Thanks, Damien.
Jared Brady, CEO of the Consumer Action Law Centre. On RN Radio Australia News Radio, or of course available as a podcast, this is The Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. Now to Queensland and a court decision in favour of Brisbane mum Mandy Zakaria. The Industrial Court of Queensland recently ruled that the former employee of McDonald's is entitled to workers' compensation. Mandy Zakaria's lawyer is Candice Heisler.
Mandy is a single mum. She's got a couple of kids. She's had a bit of a rough time. She's a hard worker. She had worked for McDonald's for about 7 years as a crew member until she had her injury.
And that injury occurred on the 1st of November 2016. What happened on that evening?
It did. She usually worked the night shift at the Richlands McDonald's store. She turned up at work 10 minutes before her shift. She went for a cigarette, which was up a ladder and on a flat roof out the back of the store. As she was coming down the ladder, she fell and had a quite serious break in her right leg.
So she broke her leg as she descended the ladder. And how did that injury affect her ability to work?
She hasn't returned to work, certainly not at McDonald's. She still struggles walking, being on her feet for long periods of time. She has attempted a return to work for Meals on Wheels, just doing some cleaning work, but her manager has said that she really struggled. She's still got pain, swelling in the leg. So it still affects her quite profoundly to this day.
So your client, Mandeep Sakaria, applied for workers' compensation. This was rejected by the Queensland WorkCover Authority. And this rejection, you appealed this, and this rejection was upheld by the Queensland Industrial Relations Commission. In a nutshell, why was it turned down?
It was turned down on the basis that at the time she had her injury, her employment wasn't a significant contributing factor. In Queensland, you can make an application to WorkCover for what we call statutory compensation, so long as you meet the requirements in the legislation, which is that you're a worker, you have an injury, your injury has arisen during the course of your employment, and employment is a significant contributing factor. The dispute in her case was whether or not her employment, that is her duties, was a significant contributing factor at the time of her injury. However, you need to then do one step further, and there's another section of the legislation which says that you are still entitled to make an application if the event happens on a day that you're required to attend your place of employment while you're temporarily absent from your place of employment during an ordinary recess.
That was the section that you appealed.
Yes.
And you appealed to the Industrial Court of Queensland.
Yep.
What was your argument?
Our argument was that her employment conditions required her to attend for her shift 10 minutes before her actual shift commenced. So her shift commences at 9 p.m. She turns up at 8:50 p.m. She goes and puts her things away and she's still got 10 minutes. She can't start work, so she can't start her duties as a crew member until 9 p.m. But it's just to help with the transition between the relevant staff. That is when she decided, I'm going to take a break. She went for a cigarette. Then we said where she was injured, the roof and necessarily the ladder follows, wasn't her place of employment at that particular time. It wasn't connected with her work duties. There were times where it was, and she needed to go up on the roof to clean. They put Christmas decorations up. But at this particular time, she wasn't actually at work. So we said, whilst the McDonald's controlled the roof and access to the roof, it was within the premises. It wasn't actually her place of employment at that particular time.
But it didn't matter that it wasn't her place of employment at the time because she was on a break within a work shift, even though presumably she wasn't being paid for that 10 minutes that she was there for the transition.
Exactly. She was effectively given a forced 10-minute break before her shift starts.
But I understand that this rooftop, where she climbed a ladder to this rooftop from a storeroom, this rooftop was not a designated smoking area. She didn't seek permission to go up to the roof. There was no explicit or even implicit encouragement to use the roof for a smoko. There was even a warning sign restricting access to the roof. What about all those factors? Why do you say that they should be not considered the most important factors when it comes to deciding whether your client gets compensation or not?
Because the section of the legislation, it doesn't even need to get that far. Firstly, there's certainly a factual dispute about any location of the sign and what the sign said. We have some evidence that suggests at least a different sign was put up after her incident, but we also had arguments that there was a common practice amongst staff that they went up the ladder and they had a smoke. We have photographs, you know, they might have had drinks on New Year's Eve because there's, you know, a lovely view. Because we argued that she was temporarily absent from that place of employment, we didn't even need to get that far. Yes, there may be some argument there was a sign there, but it's common practice. So in these types of claims, if it's common practice and no one says, hey, you actually need to stop doing that, the onus falls back on your employer to actually take steps to train and direct and instruct your staff that that's not a practice that is actually allowed. There was some dispute because she was an employee when she would be working that did need to go up and down. So if the sign says authorised personnel only, she was actually authorised personnel at least at certain points.
To clean the roof or to put up
a... Yeah, to clean the roof or those types of things.
But it does sound counterintuitive. If you're clearly instructed not to do something, you go ahead and do it anyway. Should your employer have to carry the can?
Well, that's the dispute here. We have a factual dispute about what practices were happening at the place of employment at the time. Employers will often do inductions and training, but in practice, when they've been working there for a number of years, they haven't been retrained, but employers will commonly supervise and witness their staff doing something that might be considered to be counterintuitive, and they don't actually do anything about it. So in those types of cases, sometimes the piece of paper isn't worth the training that they're alleging to have. I once represented a young man. He was a labourer. He was on a work site down on the Gold Coast. He was very young. He was brand new into the labour. His boss was on the site. He asked him to unscrew some metal. They were for demountable housing. So they were building and taking down these frames for demountable housing that would ordinarily go out to the mines. My client had got down on the ground. He put his arm and his head underneath these metal frames, which probably weighed 300 kilos. He unscrewed them, but there was nothing to hold them up. So when he unscrewed them, the top part of the frame fell on him and he had a compound fracture in his arm. But his employer, they argued contributory negligence. That was a very silly thing to do. And we said, but you watched him. You stood there and you watched him do it and you didn't say you actually need to put a support underneath that while you unscrew it. So those types of things really can impact the outcome of the assessment of whether or not there may be a contributory negligence argument.
Mm. It's about not just the instructions, but...
It's about the practice as well.
Yeah. Candice Heisler, more broadly, when it comes to workers' compensation, if you're at work and then you go on your lunch break, you go for a walk, you have an accident, mm-hmm. is that a workplace accident for the purposes of workers' compensation?
I would say yes. You'd be looking at the same sort of provisions in Ms. Zakaria's case, that you're temporarily absent from your place of employment on an ordinary recess. So if you're on your lunch break or your morning tea break and you get injured, yes.
Even if you've gone for a 2 kilometre walk around the city?
There might be some arguments about what the delay is, but it's quite common practice. I certainly know working in Brisbane City that people, you know, they go to their gym on their lunch break or they do just go for a wander around because you've got to get out of the office and get some fresh air and clear your head and all those sorts of things. I mean, a 2 kilometre walk, you might have an argument, but I would say your prospects of success are high, but you've got to look at the facts of every single case.
Even if you're going to the gym and you sustain an injury there or you're going for a jog and you fall over?
Yeah, absolutely.
What about an accident that takes place when you're travelling to or from work?
There is a journey provision in the Queensland Workers' Compensation and Rehabilitation Act. So if you're on a journey to and from work, you are entitled to make an application to WorkCover for compensation if you're injured. There's always some consideration about whether or not there's been a substantial delay. An example might be if you're going home from work, you've got to pick up your kids from school or daycare or whatever that might be, ordinarily you will still be covered. You've got to really look at the definition of substantial and the reason for the delay, how long is the delay? So perhaps if you were going home, you stopped at Chermside for 2 hours, you did some shopping, that may be considered to be a substantial delay. But if you just stopped into Coles to pick up dinner and then you continued on your journey, that may not be a substantial delay. The most common example is people get into a car accident to or from work. You are still covered by your workers' compensation. I mean, it's not necessarily your employer's fault. You may have separate proceedings against the relevant CTP insurer if the car accident isn't your fault, but you can get your medical expenses, lost wages and rehab from work cover. If you proceed with the CTP claim, you'll then have to refund those amounts to work cover. But that's all considered in those proceedings.
And what's the CTP?
CTP is your compulsory third party. So you pay your car registration, there's compulsory third party insurance. They cover the injured person.
And is that principle, that idea that you're covered by work cover for injuries sustained travelling to and from work, irrespective of their connection to your work, is that a general principle around the country or do different rules operate in different jurisdictions?
Different rules operate in different jurisdictions, so it is very much a state-by-state consideration. My understanding is a lot of jurisdictions have removed the journey provisions. I think it's an important provision. In my view, workers should be covered to and from their journey from work. There's only one reason they're on that particular journey, it's to go to work. But you got to check your state.
Check your state, yeah. There was a case in Queensland a few years ago, Dryden, and that was a man, mm-hmm. I understand, he worked at a meatworks. He was walking to his car after his shift, which was parked mm-hmm. in the car park on the premises of the meatworks, and he was attacked by a man with a baseball bat. Was that deemed to be covered by work cover, that attack?
Yeah, it was. It's a similar consideration to Ms. Sakaria's, where in that particular instance, the car park was under the control of this poor gentleman's employer, but it wasn't part of his place of employment at that particular time. The judge said, well, place of employment doesn't necessarily have to be the environment, say, in the meatworks itself, but the car park was attached. He wasn't performing his duties at that time, but he was on that recess.
He was on that recess even though he'd actually finished his shift.
Yes. There has usually got to be some form of connection with your employment, but the reason he was in that car park was because of his work, but he wasn't performing his work duties. And certainly here in Queensland, you've got your journey claims as well. You're likely to be covered so long as there's some connection or requirement to be where you are because of your work.
Finally, Candice Heisler, coming back to your client, Amanda Sakaria, how important is this decision, do you think?
It's certainly a precedent in the sense that Justice Martin has reconfirmed the importance of interpreting ambiguity in the legislation for the benefit of the worker, ensuring that there's a broad consideration about the employment conditions and requirements for workers to be at that particular place at a particular time. It could have been a very different outcome if her employment didn't require her to be at McDonald's prior to the commencement of her shift. But you still have to look at all the facts of a particular case.
Candice Heisler, thank you so much for speaking to the Law Report. A really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much for having me.
Candice Heisler, the lawyer for Mandy Sakaria. That's the Law Report for this week. A big thanks to producer Anita Barrow and to sound engineer this week, Ari Gross. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk to you next time with more law.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.